Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm really excited because I have with me Dr. Matt Kennedy to tell us all about his just published book from Manchester University Press titled The Imperial Commonwealth, Australia and the Project of Empire, 1867 to 1914, which, as those dates suggests, tells the story from the late 1800s to the early 1900s of how Australian settler colonists mobilized their particular settler experience to develop their own vision of what empire was and could be, both within the territorial confines of what we know today as Australia, the country, and beyond that, both within kind of the physical side of things of land and people, as well as what does this mean within the wider context of the British Empire. So this book adds a whole bunch to a bunch of different understandings of empire and settler colonialism. So Matt, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Well, yes, it's my very great pleasure.
I'm so glad. Before we get into your book, though, could you give us a bit of an introduction of yourself and explain why you decided to write this?
Of course, yes. And in fact, the two questions are, in a way, kind of related. So as Miranda mentioned, my name is Matt Kennedy. I currently see myself as an international and colonial historian. And I suppose what that means is that I do a lot of research into governance and governmentality of the emerging authorities that together created this kind of global system of colonialism and international imperial order in general. I've done a lot of looking into settler governments and then also practices of international governance, either through international institutions like the League of Nations or even through kind of transcolonial norms that developed in the late 1900s, or late 1800s, excuse me, in early 20th century. That effectively founded a lot of the doctrines of international governance as we know them today, or at least that's what I think. I should stop there. That's how I describe myself now. And I think largely I arrive at that description because of my work on this book. When I started this book, I wouldn't necessarily have described myself thus, mostly because I felt that I kind of had to become an expert in these different fields, or at least literate in these different fields, mostly because I really needed to, for my own sake, answer the question of what did empire actually mean to settlers and settlers in Australia in particular. I feel like I started this project in my mind, at least, you know, in the late 2000-aughts and early 2010s, which was a very exciting time to be looking into this. There's tons of literature coming out about these kinds of questions. New imperial history was really getting going, and Catherine Hall's work had kind of blown open the distinctions between what had, in my mind at least, been previously sort of siloed domains of looking at kind of a domestic settler colonial experience and then looking at a imperial relationship, and mostly with Britain. But it's because of that kind of milieu that I grew up in, I was kind of trained in at that time, that I started to look, maybe we need to, you know, contribute to a more dedicated decentering of this Anglo-Australian relationship to really understand what empire meant to a lot of these settlers in Australia. And of course, you know, as I came to discover, as I went about trying to answer that question for myself, lots of other people were already working in that field. And it was really wonderful to feel like, you know, I was kind of contributing to those wider efforts to, you know, disinter empire, disinter even the metropolitan aspect of empire, and look at the regional interconnectivity and even international connectivity between all these spaces. But even still, I felt like there wasn't a single book that really tried to tackle that question. And so with lots of generous guidance from mentors and colleagues, I decided to try, in part, you know, to contribute to the discussion, in part to satisfy my own curiosity. And here I am now. Now, arguably, you know, this isn't the book that's done it. We'll see. We'll let readers decide that, I suppose. But for me, at least, it's answered one of the questions that I feel like I've had for, I don't know, about a decade and a half. And hopefully it will go some way to answering similar questions that other people have, too.
I always think that good books come from kind of going, hang on a second, I don't quite know the answer to this. I'm going to go poke at this. And you end up being like, oh, wait, now I know all about this. Now I know about this. Oh, okay. And ideally, you get an answer. And perhaps ideally, from my point of view, that answer comes in the form of a book. And then I can ask you about it. So thank you for taking us through that sort of development and evolution of this. And I'd love to kind of first poke, I suppose, at one of the things you've mentioned, the idea of kind of getting in the mindsets of Australian settlers, because you have this really evocative phrase used throughout the book. And I'm wondering if you can take us through what you mean by, quote, the political cosmology of empire.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really thrilled that you asked this question. And would you believe it's not the first time that I've been asked this. I feel like pretty much every juncture of proposing the work, this has been one of the first questions. I relish that. I think it's really wonderful because it's been one of those conceptual apparatus that I've had with me, I think, throughout this whole journey. I suppose to describe the term very mechanistically, it's an adaptation of a concept from astronomy. Cosmology is the study of the evolution of these kind of apparently immutable forces of physical reality and how they constitute the universe as we know it, or rather how they've come to constitute the universe as we know it today. I kind of grafted the adjective political on there to signal my interest in the kind of development of understandings of power relations in human systems to that lens. And so, as I hope is starting to become clear, it's an effort to suggest that, as you say, you know, accessing these mentalities, you know, beneath these kind of very conscious political beliefs of late 19th century settler thought, there was this more or less shared set of assumptions about what kinds of things people and societies could actually do, the kind of realm of possibilities within the political or the social realms. And for me, I've always, when I have approached this question, I've always attempted to try to find a way to access these kinds of more, I guess I would characterize them as, on the one hand, more genuine beliefs based not necessarily on a kind of political ideological framework, but more of a just understanding the world around you kind of framework, these kind of immutable historical logics of human life that a lot of people sort of lived their lives according to at the time. Now, I suppose, you know, there's a pathway to arriving at that term and an empirical one at that. I think it was suggested to me, or at least, you know, the need to account for those kinds of phenomena was suggested to me really from the archive itself. As readers might pick up on when as they're reading the book, an important part of my research was investigating this kind of, you know, social intellectual archive of everyday ideas, I guess you could say, at least, you know, everyday ideas held by a certain segment of various colonial populations. So, you know, think sources like newspapers or pamphlets or books, but then also the kind of odd ephemera of late 19th century life, like, you know, speculative fiction, entertainment programs, letters written to statesmen by school children that an archivist, fortunately for us, saved and cataloged, or dinner cards with handwritten notes on them, I presume because somebody asked them to give an impromptu toast or something like that. And I guess what I saw in those sources was that there were just so many facets of life at that time, ranging from the very serious to really the, I guess we could categorize them as more human interests. They were all related in some way to the logics of a world in which empire was a kind of normalized form of human endeavor. Now, of course, ideologies of empire were also crucial to constructing this political cosmology. And I discuss this in the book, too. It's very important to realize that these cosmologies, they're models, right? They're not actual descriptions of reality. And of course, models are as much a function of ideological considerations as they are of, you know, genuine efforts to understand the world. But I felt it was really important to emphasize that, you know, for a lot of these settlers, the imperial experience that they were born into was really a kind of a schema of life as they knew it. I feel like this is often forgotten. These schemas were being confirmed by historians and public intellectuals of the day, whose work increasingly involved, instead of telling the stories of kings and queens and all of that, you know, telling the stories of peoples, telling the stories of great states and charting their trajectories. So everywhere people looked, they found this political cosmology of empire reinforced by public authorities, by intellectual authorities, by daily life to a large extent. And it's overall my contention in kind of articulating this concept and basing analysis around it that it really was, you know, the shared political cosmology of empire as much as many other things that led settlers, you know, really to see no reason to question empire as a social or political formation, even if they could be quite critical of imperialism. And I think it's important to make that distinction too, and the book tries to tease that out further, because, you know, we see these moments where imperial ideologues, mostly from London, begin making appeals for certain kinds of actions using the language of empire, using this kind of rhetorical motivation to support empire and all of that. And that met with rather mixed results. So, you know, again, what I mean here is that not everybody was a proponent of doing empire, and really quite the opposite. And I think largely because settlers could criticize practices of empire because of this conceptual apparatus that was entailed in a political cosmology of empire. So anyway, I think it's a useful concept. I think it allowed me to access these kind of interesting contours. And I think a lot of the argument of the book really hinges on teasing these two apart. You know, there's a thing that is empire, and then there is the practice of doing empire. And in the context of a federating and expanding settler society, I think, you know, that the conflict between those two ideas, and often it was a conflict, really gets teased out in lots of different ways that I found it quite worthwhile to explore.
Thank you for justifying, among other things, why I started with that question, right? It opens up so many things for us to now talk about. Yes. So one of the things I'd love to ask you about based off of that is, as you said, kind of the overall schema is not questioned, but things within it can be. And one that seems to be under discussion, right? There's many different ways it can be taken throughout what you examine in the book, is what it means to Australians to be an imperial citizen, what that was, what that counted as. Can you walk us through some of these conceptions and to what extent these changed over time?
Of course, yes. And I think, you know, at this point, you know, we've gone so far without mentioning race. And I think this is a really opportune moment to do it. Because, you know, in the late 19th century, of course, race was becoming more and more of a kind of scientific concept, I guess you could say, used by a lot of social scientists, including a lot of colonial social scientists and historians, again, including colonial historians, but then also by biologists, medical doctors, even government statisticians are readily using this concept to kind of categorize humanity, I guess you could say. And, you know, at the time, I think it's very easy to forget that race was seen as a very modern scientific concept. It was exciting. It was, you know, it was a powerful thing. It was one of the things that a lot of social scientists pointed to when they argued that they had kind of solved society in a way, and all kinds of practices of understanding how to govern, where to govern, what institutions to govern through, were sort of based on these understandings. And indeed, so was individual identity. And I think, again, kind of stepping back and taking another look at what political cosmological points of view had to offer individuals, it was a means of kind of relating very individual, very discrete, very singular lives to these very, very large phenomena, you know, the rise and fall of states. And of course, in 19th century terms, at least the lives and trajectories of different groups of people categorized into races. So we see here that, or at least I argue here, that citizenship was a really important way of kind of formalizing some of those ideas, especially in settler states. And we look at the evolution of this kind of notion of race as a determinant of belonging, I think, as at least in part, a function of the development of the particular forms of citizenship that arose in a lot of these settler states. And I would argue that they took a kind of slightly different turn than the similar kind of practice or institution in European or metropolitan states, largely because, you know, in Europe, constructing belonging, it tended, I think, to favor considerations more like political status or family prestige, as well as race, whereas in colonial contexts, race became a kind of primary determinant of this kind of mode of belonging. And I think that's borne out in a lot of literature that looks at the kind of somewhat progressive, but also, you know, very kind of racially centric creations of citizenship statuses across a lot of colonial places, a lot of Western U.S. states that, you know, had kind of frontier experience. And I don't think it's an accident that citizenship, specifically these kind of racialized conceptions of citizenship, developed first in these places. In Australia in particular, too, because you have the connection with the British world, you see a lot of these conversations that are happening in London kind of flow into colonial spaces, but then again be adapted. And so you see a lot of, you know, Greek and Roman neologisms that, in addition to being coded, of course, with racial language, they're also coded with these kind of, you know, romanticized visions of, you know, political equality, these romanticized visions, in some cases, of military service. And again, you see those being imported into law and reinforced by public discourse and, again, by scholars. And so when you kind of lift your head up, you know, in the 1880s and 1890s and take yourself out of this kind of soup of discourse, you see a vision of citizenship developing in the Australian settler colonies that on the one hand, it's quite inclusive because it does go to great lengths to include everybody who is understood to be, you know, kind of white European and specifically white British stock. But at the same time, it's quite powerfully exclusive in that it's only reserved for people of a particular race, according to these cosmological assumptions. But even, you know, within this category, we see a division between people who are thought to be, quote unquote, the kind of right racial type and people who are thought to be not necessarily of the right racial type. And that, I think, is where empire gets layered onto this. We see later on in efforts to create colonial administrations in Papua, that a lot of Australian colonial officials are thinking about this kind of model of citizenship, which is due to all white colonial subjects, but then also citizenship plus the kind of responsibility and the authority to govern, which is due only to a certain portion of white subjects in, or white citizens rather, in the Australian colonies. So it's a complicated thing and it evolves in lots of different ways, but I think, you know, it's connected to all of these trends that we see, and of course refracted through the very unique kind of settler colonial experience as well.
So I'd love to pick up on something as we explore this complexity further that you mentioned kind of almost offhand as if this is normal, and it's not, and fascinating. So I want to kind of highlight it. The idea that something happens and then it's confirmed by sort of public discourse and then it goes into law, right? Rather than the law happens, the law draws the lines and makes the categories, and then that has sort of trickle-down effects. From that perspective, one of the things that I found the most fascinating from all of these instances in the book was how the, quote, imperial individual in some senses became elevated in law at the expense of the colonial state, which I admit is not a conflict that I had necessarily expected to find in this book. Can you take us through what is happening here?
Well, yes, and to be honest, I wasn't expecting that either. I think a lot of the literature that that I had read preparing to do the research for this book had suggested that, you know, there were very clearly defined sort of hierarchies in across all of these imperial spaces, and that, you know, to a large extent, colonial states, for example, you know, colonial governments in South Australia, New South Wales, you know, they did have a degree of autonomy that was more or less recognized across the imperial system, and vice versa, those governments attempted, within some reason at least, to steer clear of the kind of, you know, the imperial government and the powers that it had reserved to itself through this kind of, you know, unwritten but unfolding constitution of the broader British imperial state. You know, when I was doing research, though, I came across so many instances where it became very clear to me that that as, so long as settlers acted as individuals, say, and not with the public authority of their states, and so long as it was in imperial interests to do so, there was very considerable latitude granted to such people who wanted to do things that were, you know, well beyond the established boundaries, constitutional boundaries, legal boundaries of what colonial states could actually permit them to do, and perhaps even were expressly prohibited in imperial statutes, so long as it contributed to this wider project of empire, and specifically of maintaining British imperial power. And, you know, I'd seen so many of these instances that at one point I had even titled the thesis that this work is loosely based on recolonizing citizenship, because I feel like, you know, the process was such a ubiquitous, or the phenomenon rather, was so ubiquitous that it really did seem like, because of, again, because of these political cosmologies of empire that so many people in Australia, so many settlers in Australia at least, had grown up with, they were kind of allowed to fudge it a little bit. They were allowed to, you know, do things that the law said, no, you probably shouldn't be able to do in order to participate in imperial endeavors. And where I think that comes at the expense of the colonial state is that it very clearly erodes colonial jurisdictions in favor of activating a kind of metaphorical civic participation in the imperial world instead of in the colonial world. And I think a lot of colonial officials saw this and many were alarmed by it, but few were dedicated enough to pursue a kind of opposition to it, that it essentially just became an accepted part of life in certain domains. And I'm thinking here, there's an example that always comes to mind, the emergence of volunteerism during this time. Settlers from Australian colonies, for example, deciding for a variety of reasons, including a feeling of racial duty, I suppose we have good records of that, to travel to faraway imperial battlefields instead of staying at home. And this practice, you know, as the book, certain chapters of the book discuss it, it emerged essentially out of these kind of settler solidarity movements, which were, you know, more permissible, I guess you could say, from a legal point of view. I think it's easy to forget that, you know, the 19th century world was characterized by considerable mobility, even though it might have taken longer to get to certain places. People were moving across these imperial zones fairly regularly. But, you know, as conflicts erupted in places across empire, settler volunteerism, the practice of it, you know, it became so ubiquitous to, in some cases, be expected. We see Australian settlers getting together, forming voluntary expeditions to go to Southern Africa in the First Anglo-Boer War, for example, or more famously to Sudan, where settlers are sent as part of an organized, public military force, and then to Burma, and then to India, and then, of course, back to South Africa during the South African War, and then to China as well. So this practice, again, became more and more kind of common, more and more legitimized. And again, colonial states had no powers to send armed forces to war. Those prerogatives and powers are still very much in the hands of the crown. And this was, a point of all constitutional points. This was probably one of the most well-established in law at that time. But especially with the Sudan expedition, New South Wales sends a volunteer contingent of about 500 people from the citizen forces and using public funds. And then when they arrived too late, they offered to send them to India. There's a conflict created here. The law says colonial states don't have the power to do this, but imperial interests kind of overrule a lot of these considerations. And so you have this odd case where these 500 settlers in Sudan are polled individually, and they sign on individually to be sent to India. And this, opens a loophole that continues to be exploited throughout the late 19th century and early 20th century. And, it's clearly the Australian colonies and eventually the Commonwealth that loses by this kind of latter-day statutory neglect. I mean, after all, it's this precedent that allows the kind of sustained erosion of colonial powers over their own subjects or citizens that leads to the assumption, for example, in the First World War, that Australia just will be at war once the British government decides to enter the conflict. And there's really wonderful literature written about this, and I think primarily of Henry Reynolds' Unnecessary Wars. There's this notion that when it comes to military service and imperial defense and all of that, Australians have historically always kind of voted in one sense or another to support British or imperial interests. They did so naively. And I think these kinds of accounts and Henry Reynolds' arguments specifically really, give the lie to that narrative. It was born of many things, this kind of digger myth, I guess you could say, but it was certainly not born of naivety. And in fact, it was born in my mind out of complicity of these colonial governments to let this narrative take hold. One reason why, of course, is imperial defense considerations. But another reason, of course, is this kind of common assumption that was operating at the time that, the British world is held together in part, at least from a settler colonial perspective, by racial solidarity. And I think there's much more to be said on both of those accounts here. But yes, there's obviously a lot of interest in this question too. I feel like recently with Australian policy towards the Asia Pacific world, I think this is one of those considerations that's left a very long legacy in Australia's defense policy and Australia's foreign affairs and all of that too. We could discuss that further. It's a topic that probably will have no end in our lifetime. So
probably not. Of the many examples you mentioned in that last answer, I'd love to ask you a little bit more about one of them, because I think that obviously I'm making some amount of judgment here, but some of the examples I think might be slightly better known than others. So I'd love to highlight one that perhaps is a little bit less known, but speaks to something you mentioned right at the beginning, the sort of regional aspects within the British Empire. Australians in India. You talk about in the book that there's a whole bunch of things going on in the 1870s and then in the 1890s, and they don't really look the same. So can you take us through kind of what's happening in the 70s, what's happening in the 90s, and how we can understand the change in Australia's relationship to China, to India?
Well, yes, I think there's very, very dramatic changes in that relationship between those two periods of time. And And thankfully, I think this relationship has it's garnered a lot more attention recently. Well, I say recently, over the past 15 years, I think scholars are really, you know, driving some really, really important historical investigations in that direction. In general, I hate to reduce it down to one thing, but if I had to choose, I really think it's the emerging kind of imperial information space that is taking hold in the 1870s, and certainly by the 1890s is very established. A lot of imperial communications communications networks are created. The telegraph was very new in the 1870s. There were some very regional telegraphic systems, but of course in 1872 there's the great overland telegraph project that connected South Australia to the wider sort of imperial network, as it were, and thus on, in fact, to London. It was still very emergent, I guess, in the 1870s. And so a lot of the information that was flowing, I think, between India and Australia was flowing through intermediaries. There was a lot of interest, but I think primarily that interest, as far as settlers were concerned, it was mediated through like missionary activities, for example, or official reports that might appear in newspapers. And occasionally there would be Indian officials who would, say, retire to the colonies, or more executive officers, like governors, who would have come from India or places administered by the Indian Empire to Australia. And there would be conduits of information flows there. And trade, of course, is a common thing. At this time, there's a lot of interregional trade going on. But, you know, the narrative, I feel like, and the information that many Australian settlers were receiving about India in the 1870s, it was much, much less direct than certainly it was in the 1890s. And by the 1890s, of course, Australians, you know, they've been linked up to telegraphic networks. Commerce has sped up. Just the magnitude of connections has sped up as well. And of course, you know, crucially, Australians I wouldn't say for the first time, but certainly for the first time in mass, are actually able to access Indian voices themselves. In the 1890s, there's a number of books published by Indian political leaders, Indian public intellectuals, Indian members of, say, the civil service, or ordinary Indians who are writing letters to papers, who are getting their voices published in imperial newspapers and then having that refracted through the kind of imperial news information space, and indeed the international news information space, to readers in Australia. And I think what that does is that, you know, by the 1890s, because just such a greater wealth of commentary is available to Australian settlers, and perhaps also because Australian settlers by the 1890s have grown both more, I guess, self-assured politically, but also are in the midst of Federation fever. They're thinking about governance. They're thinking about political norms. They're thinking about institutions like citizenship and the role of race in human affairs in general and all of this kind of thing. You know, many Australians, I think, prove much more receptive to some of the arguments and often critical arguments made by people of British government in India. And that, for some Australians, at least for some Australian settlers, rather, it tends to awaken a kind of critical consciousness that that there are vast differences in practices of empire, and Indians as historical subjects of empire may not have actually been governed that well after all. And putting myself in the minds of several Australian settler critics of British government in India. Of course, there's genuine concern and there's kind of strategic concern. A number of Australians become concerned that British styles of governance of India are actually harming the overall project of empire. Many Australians are just outright opposed to imperialism in India, just full stop. as well. And then you see this kind of curious turn among some Australian public intellectuals in the 1890s, where whereas, you know, many of them would have been happy to accept British arguments for rule over India in the 1870s, very few of them come back to those same arguments in the 1890s and view them as justified. And some of them start to argue, well, you know, British and European styles of imperial rule in general, they're these kind of old fashioned, you know, they're not scientific, they're not, and they're not responsive to the actual conditions of India. Whereas, you know, Australian settlers, perhaps because they have extensive experience managing things like drought, or at least so they would claim, you know, perhaps we're in a better position to advise, at least on the government of India. And so you see Indians also becoming this kind of foil almost amongst a number of Australian political leaders and even members of the public writing letters into newspapers, especially around the times of the Indian famine in the 1890s, early 1900s, where they're arguing essentially like, well, you know, these Indian people deserve at least the same protections, deserve to be governed well. We know how to govern these kinds of conditions better even than British administrators have proved to be. And therefore, it's not that we Australians are subjects any longer. It's that we have an equal share in this project of empire. And really, Australia should kind of take charge of a lot of these initiatives and all of that. And, you know, there's a little bit of public diplomacy here too. When the Australian Commonwealth is inaugurated, they specifically ask the Indian government whether or not, you know, the Indian government would send a contingent of Indian soldiers to help inaugurate the Commonwealth, to kind of participate in the public pageantry of the inauguration. And in my opinion, to signal precisely that, you know, when the Australians come together in Commonwealth, they're coming together as an imperial Commonwealth. They're taking seriously all of these responsibilities that they perceive themselves to have now as a newly sort of unified settler state in a world of empires. So there's a lot going on there, I think. I think Australian settler interest in India is motivated as much by a genuine interest in understanding India as it is understanding how India itself, as part of a broader imperial project, can be essentially used for the various tasks of Australian Federation and its kind of broader imperial agendas as well.
So speaking of those broader imperial agendas, you've just sort of traced for us this transition, as it were, from sort of Australia as being a settler colony as part of the empire, as subjects, to being kind of more like, hang on, we can actually do some of this empire-ness more directly ourselves. This then continues into an idea of an Australian empire. What purposes did this, you know, the idea of having an Australian empire seem to serve to Australians? And to what extent was this kind of one clear idea versus an evolving thing that changed over time?
Well, I would say it certainly evolved. I believe it evolved in several directions. The directions that it evolved in were largely predicated by these kind of broader considerations of how to legitimize empire. I think, you know, three stages maybe become clear throughout this time period, at least. You know, in the first case, and there's a lot of literature kind of begins investigating Australia's ex-continental expansionism this way, by exploring Australian efforts and really, you know, thinking of the eastern colonies, Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria's efforts to expand, claim some kind of authority over Fiji or Papua New Guinea. And many times we see that the arguments made by settler officials, they're made to justify their desires to expand from the point of view of defense. And this has been a large debate, I think, in the field in particular, because, you know, is this the rhetoric that one needs to use to kind of pitch a project of empire, even if it's a local project? Or was there a genuine belief that, you know, outlying islands taking control of them would somehow forestall, you know, a hostile actor from invading the colonies? There were some fears, I suppose you could say, of France doing so at one time, and then Germany, of course, and then at one point the Russians were feared, and then, of course, as the 19th century turned into the 20th, many of those fears became equipped with a kind of racial language and directed towards China and then later Japan. But I guess critics of that view, they often point to the fact that, well, a lot of the external statements about why Papua and why Fiji should be brought into the Australian fold may focus on defense, but a lot of the internal statements, you know, public meetings in Sydney, deliberations in executive councils and all of this, focus primarily on a trade and in particular getting access to labor. And what's interesting, of course, is that those very same polls are refracted in the public criticism amongst imperial officials about whether or not to authorize Australian expansion in those directions. You know, we see even, of course, the Colonial Office kind of famously denied Australian requests, specifically Queensland's request to take New Guinea in 1883. But I think what's often left out of that narrative is that so too did many of the Australian colonial premiers and colonial officials. And in fact, they did so because they viewed Queensland's colonial record, specifically its record of horrific colonial violence, certainly physical and cultural genocide against the indigenous peoples there and their management of indigenous labor, both locally and imported from Pacific Islands, as just categorical disqualifiers for any kind of pretensions to empire. And so you see, you know, in these debates, there's certainly a teasing out of this notion that, you know, colonialism is a very domestic, violent, and dishonorable stain, essentially, on the governance record of a lot of these places, even amongst Australian settler governments, whereas empire is something different. Empire entails, you know, ideal notions of good governance, excuse me, and you know, living up to the norms that many people in Australia and across the British world increasingly believed only white Britons could truly uphold in the world. But then, of course, fast forward to the late 1900s or late 1800s, excuse me, and early 1900s, where Australians are going through a similar kind of process in establishing once again their colonial authority in Papua. By the way, I feel like it's often forgotten that Queensland's attempts to annex Papua, or at least subject it to some kind of Australian colonial authority, they eventually succeeded. And, you know, as evidenced by the fact that Papua became an Australian colony. In these early 20th century moments, this very same debate came to the fore, although, you know, for Australians, many of the people who promoted expansion, defense, of course, was part of the equation, but and access to Pacific Island labor was of interest to some, although it was essentially, you know, shut down for a good period of time by the provisions that actually formed the new colonial government in Papua. Many Australians seem to think that just having empire itself was a legitimate end. They saw, especially after Commonwealth, they saw empire as essentially a stamp of equality, at least within the imperial system. And equality, both in a kind of individual sense, we white settlers are now doing empire. We've sort of graduated out of the settler status and are now essentially co-equals with Britons on an individual level, but also collectively. You know, the Australian Commonwealth has become an imperial commonwealth. It's become a power that's, you know, responsible for people outside of its own racial composition, or so it would say. It's doing empire now. And that, I think, is a very powerful lever within this, you know, emerging kind of dominionized British imperial world to claim equal access to formation of imperial policy and formation of imperial institutions. For example, the common citizenship or the common status, right? So citizenship status that was proposed in 1911 that would effectively give all white Britons resident in dominions the same civic status across the entire empire. Of course, you know, I think we're painting with broad brushes here. I think if we had the chance to ask individual Australian settlers, both in the 1880s and then in the early 1900s, right after the Commonwealth was formed in 1902, we might get, you know, as many answers as individuals we polled. But I think, you know, the broad brush seems to be that, you know, whereas before there were specific concerns like defense or labor, certainly by the 1900s, this notion of equality, of partnership in empire, partnership in the project of empire. And perhaps, as we were discussing relative to India, a leadership role in the conducting of empire, not just Britain's empire, but empire as a kind of, you know, pursuit of civilization, I guess you could say. Certainly they would have said something like that becomes the primary consideration. So those are the broad, the high-level contours, I would say.
Thank you for mapping them out for us. You just detailed kind of how the claim was made of legitimacy, of sort of co-equal status, which of course is half of the thing. But if you're going to claim something, then someone else has to recognize your claim. How did this transformation, this expansion of Australian empire and sort of new conception of Australia within the realm of the British Empire, how did that go down in Britain?
Well, for some people it went down easily, and for some people they never completely swallowed it, I think. The telling sort of anecdote that immediately comes to mind is from the person of William McGregor, who was a former British administrator of the British New Guinea colony, that essentially, you know, in his mind at least, he was tasked with preparing that colony for Australian administration at a future time. And I think, you know, that dynamic, first of all, is a really interesting one. You know, I can't help but think of the same kind of logics of the imaginary waiting room of history playing out here. It's not as if Australian officials were waiting to be admitted to self-government necessarily, but certainly within the kind of, you know, an imperial frame, they were waiting to be admitted to the role of governors. And, you know, we can tease that out more if we desire. At first, William McGregor, he was very, very skeptical that any Australian settler is going to be able to administer a colony that is not, you know, a self-governing colony in which, you know, only white subjects are enfranchised or even, you know, to be considered, to be honest. But, you know, about 20 years after he has this opinion, he's writing the foreword to one of the first, to a book published by one of the first Australian administrators of the colony of Papua, once it finally gets handed over, J.H.P. Murray, who articulates his own kind of vision of what a settler-inspired imperial experiment in governance should entail. He writes in that foreword essentially a kind of, you know, I don't know exactly how to describe it, but it's a compliment disguised as an insult, or perhaps it's an insult disguised as a compliment, whereas he says, you know, wherein he says essentially that I'm writing this foreword because I think essentially that, you know, if Australians are going to govern Papua, this is the best they can do. And this person, Murray, is probably the best person for the job, even though I don't necessarily think they're going to succeed. And if I had thought otherwise, I wouldn't write this foreword. And I think, again, that kind of perfectly encapsulates the opinions of many. I think there are many people in Britain, a lot of them officials, who look at these kind of Australian assertions of colonial, of imperial quality, rather, and say, well, okay, I guess we should allow some part of it in as much as it's consistent with imperial interests. But many, I think, were very skeptical of that, of the claim to full equality. And that, I think, is persistent throughout, even up until the 1940s. You know, on the Permanent Mandates Commission, for example, there's a British member of the commission, Lord Lugard, who in some ways is actually inspired by people like Murray and Australian approaches to colonial governance, and in some ways, you know, quite critical of them. And he never quite fully was willing to admit that Australian colonial governmentalities could achieve comparably, in his mind, good results as British imperial governmentality. So there's always a little bit of the superiority inferiority complex, I feel like, operating here. And I think, you know, Australians recognize this. This is part and parcel of many of the efforts, say, in the 1930s and the 1940s to more or less demand greater recognition. The Statute of Westminster, for example, in 1942 is a good example of maybe some of the legacies of this kind of conflict. So,
and arguably, I mean, I think you could probably say that some of that inferiority complex still can be seen today, looking at relations between Australia and Britain. So a very interesting sort of examination of where some of that comes from, and kind of going, hang on, we think of that as being ages ago. And yet, so another contribution of the book. I think we've done a decent job of a bit of a highlights tour of the many things that you cover. Of course, the book itself goes into way more detail about all of this. So for listeners who are intrigued, please do pick up the actual book that goes into much more detail. But Matt, before I let you go, would you mind sharing with us if there's anything you're working on now or next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you could give us a sneak preview of?
I would love to. Yes, and in fact, I'm working on three different things at the moment, and I'll try to be brief in describing each, but they're all, in a way, kind of related to this project as well. So, you know, the first, there's been a longstanding project that I've been working on with a colleague, Chris Holdridge, about what we characterize essentially as the first global system of mass military internment. That was established during the South African War to house essentially half of the Boer field army. And it was distributed all across the empire, which we think is interesting, which led to all kinds of questions about, you know, the equality of imperial jurisdictions, whether or not, you know, these kind of nascent international humanitarian conventions like the Hague Conventions applied, and specifically whether or not the system could be used to surveil and essentially kind of, you know, do a little bit of social engineering of the post-war colonial state, which we argue it was effectively turned into a system for doing that. So that's one project. The second project, which I guess I alluded to in brief is, looking a little bit more closely at the development of the domain of quote unquote scientific governance that was developed by Australian colonial administrators in Papua. I see this as a really interesting thing because it's the first, one of the first approaches to colonial governance that explicitly tries to align itself with emerging social sciences like anthropology and ethnography, and even approaches to law like economic positivism and all of that to essentially create more or less ideal administrations in colonial zones that many Europeans at least thought were peopled by people who were quote unquote, living in Stone Age conditions. What I think is fascinating about these kinds of experiments in colonial governmentality is that a lot of them are refracted and picked up in the administrations of Class C mandates, whose administrators in Europe feel very similarly about the state of subject peoples and look at the legacies essentially of governance based on those kind of horrific and really appalling ways of understanding the political conditions of subject peoples. And then I guess third, and somewhat relatedly, there are some explorations in the book about the use of big data to, say, model the weather, for example. The rise of colonial statistics went hand in hand with the projects of, quote-unquote, scientific governance, not only within Australia, but also in many of Australia's colonies, and indeed many European colonies in the 20th century. It's perhaps not realized that a lot of those statistics gathered at the time were turned into data sets for, and here we're going to take a sharp left turn, training large AI models. And there's a project underway, amongst a lot of digital humanities and kind of technology savvy historians looking at essentially decolonizing this kind of data. Because after all, when we predict the weather these days, we're relying on data that was gathered in colonial contexts and many other applications as well. So I'm not sure which one will be finished first. They're all proceeding apace, and the difficult thing of deciding which one to work on is made even more difficult by the fact that the world itself, seems to urgently need answers to these kinds of questions as well. So it's a little bit of a one step forward here, one step forward there endeavor, but they proceed slowly but surely, I guess.
That's great. Thank you so much for previewing all three of them for us. And while you take those steps forward, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled The Imperial Commonwealth, Australia and the Project of Empire, 1867 to 1914, published by Manchester University Press. Matt, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Well, once again, thanks. It's been a great pleasure. It's wonderful to talk about the book, its ins and outs. And yes, I look forward to hearing what people think of it.